WMMC HD3 Detroit, KMPS HD3 Seattle, WBMX HD3 Boston,
and on AOL Radio
and Yahoo Launchcast.
CBS Radio's The New Sky.
Enlightened philosophers tell us that we are divine beings in human form. Let's get real here. How can we live a busy life with a job, kids, and a mortgage and still be spiritual? Join CJ Liu as she tackles real life issues through a spiritual lens and talks with experts in relationships, work, and more. You'll get practical life skills and learn how to touch, feel, and experience a whole new way of living. Be a force for good. And fire it up with CJ. Log on, fireitupwithcj.com, and call CJ now.
248-545-SOUL.
CBS Radio's The Sky.
Live from the headquarters of CBS Sky Radio, Fire It Up with CJ, now at fireitupwithcj.com. We're coming to the end of the June pretty quickly here, and this month is all about exploring what it'll take to live in balance and harmony with the planet and life around us. Hi there, CJ.
Hey, welcome everybody. How are you doing, Eric?
I'm doing great.
Yeah, so this is an exciting time. I have the best guest ever coming on today. I have Richard Bandler, and I have been reading his book, Getting the Life You Want. And, Eric, I got to tell you, it is the ultimate self-help book. The ultimate self-help book. I work as a life coach, and so I talk to a lot of clients and look, and basically every single problem that they've ever been, have ever brought to me, a solution is in this book, Get the Life You Want. So I am thrilled to have Richard Bandler here today. Is he there? Richard, are you there?
Yes, I am. I'm right here.
Let the fun begin. So excited to have you here. I have just enjoyed your work, your personality, your spirit. I'm so excited to have you here. Thank you for being here.
Well, it's a pleasure.
So I want to find out all about you, and I want to find out about how did a math major end up becoming the self-help guru. Now, you started off in the early 70s. Where were you when you started off all this work, and where are you now?
Well, back in the 1970s, I wasn't a math teacher. I was a student, actually.
Okay.
And at that time, in computers, there were things called compilers, and we were trying to teach machines to talk to human beings. And there was a set of skills called modeling, by which you looked at a successful statistician, found out what he was doing, and you taught a machine to imitate that behavior. And inadvertently, I met a very talented psychotherapist named Virginia Satir, primarily because I was living in a house that was owned by a psychiatrist. And he kept bringing by different people who were psychiatrists, and as they talked about therapy, it seemed like this endless, non-ending process. But Virginia was working with people in one or two sessions and getting them help that they needed.
Wow.
So, but when she'd do things, people would look at her and go, oh, it's just intuitive. But mathematicians know that mathematics is intuitive, and yet it can be taught. You can change your intuitions. If somebody is a native speaker of English, they have intuitions about English. And if they're a native speaker of Russian, you have a different set of intuitions. You know what a well-formed sentence of your language is if you were born and grew up speaking it. If I go, ideas colorless green, you know it's not a well-formed sentence of English. Mm-hmm. So intuitions can be trained. So first I set out trying to find out what psychotherapists did that worked and ignored what they were saying the theories were. Because there were 160 schools of psychotherapy all claiming to have the right approach, and yet none of them were getting hardly any results at all. If somebody walked in with a phobia of snakes, the odds are 5 years later, they'd end up with 300 phobias instead of getting rid of one. It almost worked in the inverse fashion, that people actually weren't getting better with what it is that they were asking for.
Right.
So what I began to do is use the same skills to model what Virginia did, so regardless of what she said she was doing, somebody else could get the same results.
Right.
And I became dissatisfied because there weren't enough people that could do enough good things. So I finally started going out and finding people who had successfully solved problems. And ultimately, I started looking at what a successful salesman did, a successful pilot. I worked for the military, modeling like successful shooters, people who could fire M16s, people who could memorize things. We found out what made good spellers and started teaching children who were supposed to be learning disabled to spell in a week rather than in years. And so over four decades, I've had a very long, very successful career because I know I don't have all the answers, but I know somebody out there does. And when I find them, I've developed the skills to find out what they do both consciously and unconsciously so that I can teach people both hypnotically and otherwise to be able to have better choices, as you saw in the book that you described reading.
So when you're observing these folks, is it, you know, are you behind a glass mirrored? I'm always been curious, like, are you behind a glass mirrored wall watching them? Or are you, like,
lurking in their office? Why would I get behind a glass mirrored wall?
I don't know. I'm trying to figure out what is your observational techniques. I mean, how did
well,
you
Well, I ask a lot of questions because most people don't have any idea what they're actually doing. Mm-hmm. And they don't know what gets them into trouble. And they also don't know what works. That, you know, about 80 to 90% of our behavior is systematically unconscious, and it has to do with the structure of our neurology. So the more we've learned about neurological learning, that is how we grow neurosynaptic pathways and how we alter from one to the other, the more I've been able to develop techniques where we can use our conscious mind to control our unconscious behavior. Because people don't decide to become afraid of a snake, it just happens. And once it's learned, it doesn't require much effort to do it any more than it does to shake somebody's hand. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all these little behaviors we learn amass. We have millions and billions of neural cortical pathways. And in computer systems, especially back in the old days, back when floppy disks were 2.5 feet across, there were two kinds of memory systems. One is temporary, that's read-write memory, and one is permanent, which is archival. And human memory is very much archival, which means when the data changes, you have to put something on top of it so it doesn't. So even though we may have had 20 phone numbers, we know which one we have now without remembering all the old ones. We just go to the most recent thing, and we don't go back to the old things. Mm-hmm. So the trick is to put new learnings in front of ones that don't work. So that when people have fears, you teach them a mental process by which they put a new response in front of their fears so they never go back. Because you're only born with two fears, loud noises and falling. Mm-hmm. All the rest of them are acquired over time. Some of them are good. You know, you don't want to be jumping off of high buildings and stepping in front of buses.
Yeah.
But, you know, when people are terrified of things like bugs and snakes, especially pictures of snakes, the movie Jaws came out, I made a fortune because there were people in Kansas who wouldn't swim in their swimming pool.
Wow. Wow. Interesting. So let's go back to when you were observing folks and you were basically looking at how do you, you know, so you're listening to Virginia Satir or Milton Erickson and you're watching them. What is it that, and you say, you know what, it is describable. What they're doing is, actually, I could program a computer to do this. I'm going to watch what they're doing. What is it
The difficult part is to find out what the valuable part of what they're doing is, because I pay attention to everything. In Milton's case, I even wrote musical intonation of the rhythmic patterns of his voice. And, you know, he claimed to be tone deaf, but yet he had very good control over his tone. Well, we look at the syntax, we look at the sequence of how they instruct somebody to manipulate their thought patterns. Because our thought, conscious thought, is made out of pictures and words and feelings and smells and tastes. And then the question is, how big are they? How close are they? Are they right and the left? Are they black and white? Are they color? And when you go through and you ask people very detailed questions about these things, you get very detailed answers.
Interesting. So you were saying to them, so how were you able to discern the valuable from the not valuable? Was it you were looking at the inputs and the outputs that were created? Like he said this.
I'm sorry, I'm having a little trouble hearing you.
Oh, okay. So you said that part of it was discerning what was valuable and not valuable.
Well, if you can distill, and I mean, this is what mathematicians are taught to do. If you distill down what the necessary steps are as opposed to the extraneous steps, and you talk to 100 people that have gotten over a fear or 100 people that spell well, you find out what's left that's in common and what's extraneous. It's really a numbers game.
Right.
And in Milton's case, figuring out what made him a good hypnotist, I had I had to take all of the ways he talked and his intonation patterns and the kinds of ways he phrased syntax and go through and delineate them all and then find out what the necessary parts were to assist people in going into altered states and then finding out which altered states were good for what.
Wow.
That as a hypnotist, he always tried to put people in as deep a trance as possible. And the trouble is that produces a lot of amnesia. And to me, I'm not trying to control somebody else's behavior. I'm trying to teach people to be in control of their own mind.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the early 80s, I wrote a book called Using Your Brain for a Change. And it outlined literally how you take the conscious mind and think of it as a bus, and your job is to steer it, and the unconscious is to do everything else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the wheels, the motor, everything that drives it. Your job is to aim your life so that you pick good goals and you go after those goals. And even if people stop and think, if you think of a really good decision you made, and then you think of a really bad decision you made, and the good decision has to be good at the time and still good, and
mm-hmm.
the bad decision was just a dumb thing that you thought was a good idea, when you think about them, the pictures aren't even in the same place in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, one is further away, one is to the right or the left, and they're a different size.
Mm-hmm.
When you discover that your good decisions and your bad decisions are sorted out in your mind differently, then you can begin to notice when you're making bad ones and do something about it.
Yeah.
And the same thing is true about fears. Most people who have fears, when they think about the things, they're very large in their mind. It's like sitting in the front row at a huge theater. It's not like sitting in the back, in the balcony, you know, way in the back watching something. People aren't afraid of pictures that are the size of their cell phone. They're afraid of things that loom up and are large. The larger the pictures are in your head, the more strength and intensity your feelings have. And most of these things are thought to be out of your conscious control, and they simply are not. There are ways to control them and little tricks of mind that I've been stacking up by the hundreds for years now.
And
the book that you read is full of them. It tells you how to reduce a fear and how to get over bad memories. I mean, when people, you know, have bad memories that they think about every day, even if they just think about them for 2 minutes here and 5 minutes there, it'll add up to 30 minutes or an hour a day. And when you start calculating that out, you know, an hour a day, 352 days, you know, adds up to hundreds and thousands of hours over a period of 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at, you know, I always have clients do this. How much time do you spend worrying about this? How much time do you spend afraid of this? How much time do you spend thinking about it?
Yeah.
When we do seminars in London, I always bring in tarantulas and big snakes and spiders and all these things. And what's funny is when I tell the people that I'm going to do it, they start freaking out a week in advance. I go, next Saturday, I'm going to bring in snakes and spiders and rats. And there'll be people going absolutely ballistic in the audience. And I'll pull them up on the stage, and I'll go, you know, this should tell you something. And they go, what, that I'm afraid of spiders? And I go, no, because there are no spiders here. You're afraid now. You're afraid of the idea of the spider. People are afraid of the idea of being abandoned. They're afraid of the idea of something.
Mm-hmm.
And ideas are very powerful when it has to producing effects on us. What we think controls how we feel, and therefore controls what we do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that it's the mental management that you mentioned in one of your books. I thought that it's profound. It's simple and it's profound, but we spend so much time in our heads, not even conscious about how much time we're wasting and spending in our heads thinking completely ineffective things. It's
well,
sad.
If you think about it, I've had people tell me that, you know, they think about something bad that happened years ago every day because it was terrible.
Yeah.
And when you find out how much, if it, you know, I've had people tell me they spend 2 hours a day, you know, 5 minutes here, 10 minutes there, 20 minutes here, and sometimes even more. And, you know, you're talking 7,000 hours in a year. You're talking enormous amounts of hours over 10 years. And when you look at them and you go, so you're planning to do this for the next 20 years. You're going to spend, you know, 15,000 hours feeling bad in this way. That makes you a pretty good psychic if you think about it.
Exactly. All right, we're going to be right back.
You can plan that this is your plan, and they always look at me and they go, well, I don't think it was smart.
Yeah, it's not a smart plan.
It's not smart, because if you know ahead of time you're going to do it, then it means that you have a choice.
Yeah.
And the choice is produced by reducing the size of the pictures, turning them white, blinking them black and white, taking control of the things that happen automatically. And the first step is always to make them worse. Because, you know, if you got something that really bothers you and you make it louder in your head and you make it bigger in your head and your feelings get worse, what it means is you can control it. Because if you can make it worse, you can make it non-existent.
Richard, we have to take a break, so we're going to actually talk more about your choices and creating a new plan, and we're going to actually, Richard's going to walk us through an exercise on how to do that. We'll be right back.
CBS Radio's The Sky.
The Sky.
Now back to Fire It Up with CJ. Be a force for good and fire it up with CJ. Log on, fireitupwithcj.com, and call CJ now.
248-545-7685.
On CBS Radio's The Sky. Sky.
We're back with CJ on Fired Up with CJ. Our guest today is Richard Bandler, and we're talking about neuro-linguistic programming, fears, and how to overcome them. And now back to CJ.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. So we are fortunate to have Richard Bandler here today, and he is going to walk us through an exercise. And so we're going to be walking through an exercise where he is going to be taking a bad habit or something that you want to get rid of.
Let's take something simple. Let's just take a bad memory.
A bad memory.
A memory that you think about way too much, and it makes you feel bad.
Okay. All right. So we're going to take a bad memory, and you're going to demonstrate some of the things that we're talking about the previous segment of how to take that bad memory and replace it with a good memory. What are we going to replace it with?
No, no, no. Let me do this. This is my job.
Okay. You do your job. I'm just going to sit
here. Guessing is not a part of it. That's how people get into trouble. They start guessing things.
Okay.
See, if you have a bad memory, the first thing I can, if it really bothers you, I can pretty much guarantee that it's big. It's either life size or larger than life. Because if, in order for it to bother you, it has to have a big screen. And so if you look at it and it makes you feel bad, that's pretty much, you know, it's at least almost life-size. And if you actually think about it and it's making you feel bad, your feelings are actually going to spin forward, backwards, clockwise, or counterclockwise, because those are the only choices. And if you're looking at it and you notice you take your hand and literally spin it in a circle forward and a circle so it tumbles backwards and then go clockwise and counterclockwise, you can kind of figure out which way it's going. This is called your entenic nervous system. And it's the connection between all of your hollow and solid organs. And it's what makes us feel bad. That's how we retain bad feelings, is that we can do them over again. Now, if you look at this big picture and suddenly you snap it down to a circle about 2 inches in size and see the picture, then turn it black, see the picture, turn it white, see the picture, turn it black, and make it so it flickers, go that fast in your mind. When you go back and try and think about it again, it will be difficult.
Hmm.
You have to do it really quick because the brain doesn't learn slowly. If I handed you a picture on a card and I gave it to you once a week, you'd have no idea what it did. But if I flicked through it like a deck of cards, you'd see the stick figure get up and dance and throw a basketball through the hoop.
Hmm.
It's because the brain has to pattern by speed. So when you take this big memory and you go, turn it to a little circle and go, and go along like that, what happens is it begins to train your neurology not to stop at the bad feeling. But when the bad feelings start, it trains you first to reduce the intensity and then to turn it and saturate it white and saturate it black. Because, you see, in the old days, we had TVs, they had a knob on it called the brightness knob.
Mm-hmm.
And if you turned it, you could turn the whole screen absolutely white or the whole screen absolutely black. And when we think about memories, we always start at the beginning and we run through a portion of it while we're feeling bad. That's why we do it.
Right.
So if you actually freeze frame it, it's not going to produce the feelings. When you shrink it and start to blink it, then what happens is it teaches your neurology to have a next step. Don't just stay in this loop of feeling bad about something. You go in your mind and you do something, you do it quick enough, and the bad feeling won't come up. Did you try it?
I did. I took my bad memory, I shrunk it down, and then spun it around. And
blink it black and white really fast. And then if you take a deep breath, open your eyes, and then try to think about it again.
I still have it, so maybe I didn't do a good job.
Well, you still have it? Is it the same size?
No, it's smaller.
It's smaller, so it doesn't make you feel so bad.
Right. Right. So do you
so
just
if
keep
you shrink
doing
it down
it?
Faster and blink it faster, then what will happen is you do that two or three times, pretty soon it becomes difficult. Then there's one other trick. Then what you do is you go to the end of the memory and you start running it in reverse. So everybody walks backwards, talks backwards, and you throw in a little circus music. Look like a Charlie Chaplin thing. People will talk to you.
Okay,
when
that works.
When you run memories backwards, it flattens out the strength that's in the neurological circuit that maintains it. Because since you always run it forwards, the charge from one cell to the next builds up and expects to go that way. When you run a memory backwards, it flattens it out, so it won't run by itself so well.
Right.
Did you try that?
Yes, I did. And you know what? That was the thing that did it. When I did that, I know because I actually get a little energetic shock in my body. I go boop, like it's like a, I don't know, shock deep, but I don't know how to describe it, but I get a little bit of a shock when things shift. So I felt that when I did that.
Well, the giveaway is that you're, if you do this well enough, your feelings will spin in the opposite direction. You can actually force them to if you want to. If you notice they're tumbling forward or feeling spinning backwards, which way were your feelings going?
Mine were going forward. They're going
okay,
kind of
so make them go a little faster. It'll get a little worse. You slow it down and start to spin it in the opposite direction. Then you spin it faster and faster in the opposite direction, and it'll disappear.
Yeah.
Now, I've done this with people who have come back from wars. See, most of these vets that come back, when they're in such a state of adrenaline for so long, what happens is when they come back, their life doesn't feel real. And, you know, it doesn't have the intensity that they remember it having when they left, because probably, you know, the most intense thing they did was drive 70 miles an hour in a car or maybe kiss a girl for the first time. And you go to these places where every moment you have to be totally alert. You're firing off the fight-flight reaction over and over again, and you live in a state where there's so much adrenaline that when you come back, nothing seems quite real.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can diminish the intensity of these things and shrink these memories down and whiten them out and run them in reverse, and then take the things that you remember and make them bigger and brighter, it helps these people to get over the post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
I've been working with this all the way back to the Vietnam War, in fact, to the Korean War.
Has there ever been anyone that you just can't work with or like, just never work?
Yeah, some of my relatives are annoying. I can't do anything about them.
What do you think is the
problem? There are some people that are just a pain in the ass, and I want nothing to do with them, and there are people who can't follow instructions. I had a schizophrenic once that just wouldn't do anything I asked him to, and I finally looked at his family and said he's too much trouble. You know, I mean, I have done things where they're incarcerated, where I've gotten their attention by doing things. I used to do that a lot when I was younger. You know, somebody thought they were Jesus Christ, I'd take them out and crucify them. I'd always do it on Good Friday because I was fond of being able to look at them and go, you know, what day it is, and they go, no, and I go, it's Good Friday. Good for me, but not so good for you.
All right, so there have been, but it's usually because their mind isn't open to it. Is it because they're
it's even more than that. It's just that some people they want nothing to do with you. I can't force anybody to do anything. I'm not in that business. I'm in the business. Most of the people that come to me, they come to me as a last resort. I would say in the past four decades, 95% of the people I've worked with have said in the first five or six sentences that I'm their last hope. They've been through every kind of therapy. They've been through everything. You know, they went, you know, even kids with learning disabilities, their parents have said, we've tried everything. We've tried this, we've tried this, we've tried that. So when people come to me, pretty much they've given up hope. So they'll pretty much try anything I ask them to, which is all I really need. I need to get them into a different state of consciousness, which is why I use a lot of hypnosis.
Right.
Because a lot of our inhibitions that stop us from learning are a result of just the way we're, our habit of thinking. You know, I've had a lot of, in the past probably 15, 20 years, people who are fairly wealthy that have paid me because they've gone to rehab five, six, seven times and gotten nowhere. You know, I had a musician who, you know, was getting kicked out of a band that it was hard to believe you would get kicked out of. You know, because he took so much drugs, he couldn't function. And, you know, when he came in, I even said to him, I said, do you have any? And he said, no, and looked over at his coat. So I grabbed his baggie, and when I pulled the baggie out of his pocket, good God, it was like a pound of flour. It was unbelievable that he even carried that around with him. And
right.
when I laid it out on the table, I said, do you want to take this? And he went, absolutely. And I said, so let's do the catalog. So far, you've lost your family. You're about to lose your income. You've wasted hundreds of thousands of dollars. You've made yourself sick. You've had a heart attack. And you want to do it again. And he went, absolutely. He goes, I know it will make me feel good. And when I said, how do you know? He said, oh, I just know. And whenever you hear that word just, it's the barrier between conscious and unconscious thought. The word just means only in logic. And it means I'm only thinking about this. I'm not thinking about other stuff. So when I got him, I asked him, I said, when you think about it, is it a slide or a movie? And he goes, oh, it's just a still picture. I see the straw on the Coke, and I know how it's going to make me feel. And I said to him, I said, well, let's turn it into a little longer movie. So I had him run a whole feature-length film where when he looked down, he saw himself getting high over and over and over again, getting kicked out of the van, running out of money, getting sued for everything he has, ending up in an alley with somebody pissing on him. And I said, do you want it now? And he looked at me and goes, not so much. And I said, well, see, you're making a life decision based on a little tiny picture.
Right.
And sometimes people have great big long movies when they really only need a few slides. And
right.
sometimes people, you know, have a still picture when they need a long thing that goes into the future that shows them what's going to happen. This is why we have brains, is to think. And most of NLP really boils down to teaching people to think appropriately given the things that they're doing. When I get rid of a bad memory, I always look at people and I go, do you know what you just did? I said, do you know what this is called? And they look at me and they go, neuro-linguistic programming? I go, no, it's called thinking. What you were doing before was just remembering. That's why you could feel bad exactly the same way over and over again. All I asked you to do was to think differently, so therefore you could feel differently, so therefore you could do different things.
Love it. All right, we're going to be right back. We're going to be taking a break. We'll be right back with Richard Bandler.
CBS Radio's The Sky.
The Sky.
Now back to Fire It Up with CJ. Be a force for good. And fire it up with CJ. Log on, fireitupwithcj.com. And call CJ now.
248-545-7685.
On CBS Radio's The Sky.
Sky. Before we go back to CJ, I want to give you a website. You can catch her past shows, new events, and all sorts of things at fireitupwithcj.com. You can also follow her on Facebook. Now back to CJ.
Hey, guys. Welcome back. I have been mesmerized. I think I've been hypnotized by Richard Bandler, who's here hypnotizing me on air without me even recognizing it. So we were talking about Richard Bandler and his work in neuro-linguistic programming. So welcome back, Richard. Have you been hypnotizing me?
It's in my nature.
You can't help it. Okay, so you've mapped out pilots, you've mapped out salespeople, military. I mean, who do you still want to map out?
Oh, there's always something interesting that comes along. I mean, to me, it's oddly enough, from everybody I meet, I learn a little something. You know, everybody thinks a little differently, and, you know, I did a thing with actors one time, and I found out how they memorize scripts, and then I taught children to use it for memorizing other things. You know, it's you take a little bit here and you put it over there. There's not a whole lot of difference between an interior decorator and a schizophrenic, other than the fact that the interior decorator goes out and buys the furniture and builds it, and the schizophrenic lives with it without it being there. To me, you know, there's when you define people as being crazy or being schizophrenic or being depressed, as opposed to looking at these behaviors as what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And to me, one of the big changes was that I started looking at this not as something that was wrong with somebody, but just what they were doing. That somebody was unhappy because they were thinking a certain way. Somebody was depressed because they were thinking a certain way. And, you know, whether somebody has big fears or big self-doubts or somebody is got the determination to get through very difficult things. I recently released a book called The Ultimate Introduction to NLP.
Mm-hmm.
And basically what it is it's a story about somebody going to a three-day seminar. And when we put on big seminars and there are hundreds of people, you know, sometimes thousands, and they go for 3 days, we present them enough information about controlling their thoughts that it's very life-changing for people. And one of the big learnings is that, you know, that you're not a byproduct of your past. When people go, where did my problems come from? I tell them birth. It caused everything. Had you not been born, you wouldn't have these difficulties. But you also wouldn't have the magic moments that are available.
Mm-hmm.
And the trick is to have more good moments than bad ones. And when, you know, when people are manic depressive, the doctors say, oh, you've got a chemical imbalance. Well, yeah, but so do great artists and great musicians and great people who write poetry. And, you know, it's not always that it has to be suffering. You know, if you adjust your thoughts, it adjusts your body chemistry.
Okay,
go to a doctor and have their body chemistry adjusted in another way, but you should always try to augment it, because it amazes me that even on TV, they're pushing antidepressants, and then they're pushing pills that, if your antidepressants aren't working, will make them work better. So you have antidepressants for your antidepressants. And to me, you know, that being happy is a skill. It's not a byproduct of being born with the right parents and having the right circumstances. It's something that you learn to do. And I wrote a book called The Secrets of Being Happy because I wanted people to realize happy people are people with a purpose. You know, they come up with something to do that fulfills their life. And, you know, sometimes we look at people like this as being driven, but they do it because they enjoy it. And there's like a list of things that a very simple list. People who have a lot more friends and families and people who, you know, it's like I found out that having high self-esteem isn't very difficult. All you have to do is the right thing for the right reason. And most people know what that is. Everybody knows that stealing is bad, but yet people do it anyway, because they get a thrill from it, but they don't end up feeling good about themselves. Whereas if you do the right thing for the right reasons, if somebody drops an orange and you pick it up because they have a bag of groceries, if you pick it up so other people will see you, you don't get to feel good. But if you pick it up because it's the right thing to do, you get to feel good about yourself. It's not complicated to have high self-esteem. But yet, when I worked in the school system, they were saying kids couldn't spell and couldn't read because they had self-esteem problems, because they had bad families. Well, you know, I grew up in a very unpleasant environment, and, you know, you can be happy anyway. People survived prisoner of war camps and came out happy people. It's just that you have to think about it properly. And learning to do these things and learning from the people that have done it. So when I look for people who are happy, I look for people who are happy in the worst of situations and found out they all had things in common. When I wrote the book, The Ultimate Introduction, I wanted to present a story that people could read, that they could just read it like they were reading a short novel and have the same experience as going to a seminar and come out of it learning how to think differently, learning how to change the volume of the voice in their head and whether it's on the right or the left, having some kind of controls. I mean, good heavens, if we didn't have controls on our ovens, we wouldn't be able to cook. If we don't have controls on our TV, if you don't like what you're watching, you can change the channel.
Mm-hmm.
And yet most people have no control over how they're thinking or what they're doing.
So the Ultimate Intro to NLP, which I've read, is a really fast read. And in fact, it does exactly what you said, of course. But it's like going to what I felt as a reader is I felt like I was walking through the experience with the gentleman who had gone to the seminar, and I was hearing your words and then how they affected him, and I really did feel like I was going to, you know, of course I'm not going to get the full benefit of going to your seminar, but as much as you can through a book.
There's a difference between spending a couple of $1,000 and But I think it's a good read, and it gives people a window into something that allows them to be able to think differently.
Yeah. Yeah. So I want to go back to the comment you made about the kids and having a healthy self-esteem. So, I mean, how do you think that people can do that for their children?
Well, if you know how people spell, because the truth is, when I went into the school systems and they gave me kids, they said, well, we're going to send you over to talk to the educational handicapped teacher, which was a good name for her. Mm-hmm. And it was even written on her door. And when you see on the door, educationally handicapped counselor. And I walked in, and she started telling me, you know, I said, I want the 5 worst kids in the school, kids that you think cannot be helped. And she pulled out the file, and she told me one of them was cross-hemisphered. And I said, are you telling me that the right hemisphere is actually on the left? That would just make them left-handed, wouldn't it? And she said, no. She said, I said, have you taken x-rays? And she went, no, it has nothing to do with x-rays. We give them a diagnostic test. And these are 5th graders, and they're giving them diagnostic tests and identifying it as a pathology. And when I said, what can't they do that makes them handicapped? And they started going down the list. They go, well, they're not spelling at a 5th grade level. They're spelling at a kindergarten level. And so I went out and found the person that won the spelling bee in California. And it was a smart little young, you know, 9-year-old girl, and found out. I said, how do you spell words? And she said, what word? And I said, how about the word phenomenological? And she started barking out letters. And I said, no. I said, don't tell me what letters in the word. How do you know which letters to tell me? And she said, well, I can see them in my mind. And I said, how big are they? And she held her hands, and it was about 10 inches in size. And she pointed to each letter, and she could read them forwards and backwards. And what she did is looked at a word when it was written down or typed and put this big thing up in her mind and memorize it and then look away and say the word and put the word back and then make sure it was the same as the one on the paper. Hmm. And so I taught kids to make this big picture thing in their head. And in fact, I told them it was how you cheated. And when I took all 5 of these kids and had them make 12-inch letters in their head, in fact, I wrote them on what we used to call a blackboard, but I wrote them with different colored chalk. And I wrote up all the words they were supposed to spell, and I wrote them in different colors, and I wrote them 10 inches big, and I had them memorize them as 10 inches high. And then I asked them, like in the word color, I'd go, what color is the letter L? And if they told me it was blue, then I knew they had an eidetic image instead of, because what you do is you construct images with one hemisphere, you memorize them with the other.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can get people to construct big pictures of words as a habit, they do it automatically.
Mm-hmm.
In my seminars, I teach adults to do this to memorize names so that they connect the face itself with a caricature and then write a name underneath it and then read the name and check to make sure it's correct. See, our ability to input data, how we encode data, is directly related to how we decode it. And if it's not encoded properly, it's hard to recall it.
Mm-hmm.
And teaching children to do that. I just put out an audio tape, which is about addition, because I find the way they teach addition to be ridiculous, because most people can add and multiply up to 10, and then it stops. Because I don't know why, because multiplying, you know, 2 bigger numbers together wasn't something. They didn't really learn to multiply.
No, it's how
they
we were taught to do it.
Tensies.
And, yeah.
If you teach people properly, then what happens is they build a machine in their head that produces the result.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, whether that result is being happy or whether that result is being determined or whether that result is spelling. And I find that once you teach kids to succeed at tasks, then they feel good about themselves anyway.
Right.
And instead of trying to get them to feel good because there's no failure in the system.
Interesting. So my grandson was
telling me that, you know, that at school that they, you know, they don't keep score, they don't get grades, they don't do anything. So how do you know if you're doing things correct?
Yeah, we have Richard Brandler. We are going to be right back. You have to go to break.
Okay.
CBS Radio's The Sky.
The Sky.
Now back to Fire It Up with CJ. Be a force for good. And fire it up with CJ. Log on, fireitupwithcj.com. And call CJ now.
248-545-7685.
Believe. On CBS Radio's The Sky.
The Sky.
We're back with CJ on Fire It Up with CJ. Our guest today is Richard Brandler, and we're talking about neuro-linguistic programming. Now back to CJ.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. So we've been talking about Richard's new book, Ultimate Intro to NLP, and the book that I loved reading, which is the Ultimate Self-Help Book, Get the Life You Want. And so welcome back, Richard. I have a question for you. So
okay, fire away. That's what your ad says. Get fired up.
All right. So did you ever think that NLP, you know, like you said when we were during the break, you said this is something, you were like a one-man show. Now there's like hundreds and thousands of practitioners and master practitioners, and it's a worldwide thing. Did you ever think it would get this big?
Actually, I didn't know it would happen as quickly as it did. The truth is that neuro-linguistic programming has something which basically undermines the field of psychology in principle. The field of psychology has, starting with Freud, a basic principle that says the following, that something went wrong, and if you can figure out what it is, that through this insight into yourself, you will become a better person. Mm-hmm. So the basis of insight is that by exploring and archaeologically digging through your past and finding out where you went off the tracks, that somehow or other, magically knowing this, will make it so that your problems disappear and you'll be a better person. Mm-hmm. Now, I personally think the best thing about the past is that it's over. And neuro-linguistic programming, really as a basic field, says it doesn't matter what happened. What matters is that you keep doing the same things over again, so therefore you get the same results.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, that was Einstein's definition of insanity, was doing the same thing and expecting a different result. What we do instead is model the most successful things and then try to figure out what would be next. So that if you change the way you think, it negates all of the things that you've learned. So that you, so to speak, you start planning. The difference between remembering and thinking is that thinking will produce new behaviors. Yeah, and if you think in a way that works, you can repeat it. Then it's worth remembering. But if you're thinking the same way, if you try to spell phonetically, you can't even spell phonetics phonetically. It's a ludicrous system. But yet, every year they hand children these little books that say on the front of them, Pahonics. It's an absolutely insane system. And yet they don't just do it here. Now, if you were in Germany, you can almost spell German phonetically. Mm-hmm. But actually, if you're going to spell, you need big pictures of words so that you can copy the letters down. From common sense point, it just makes sense. Since what you're doing is writing a picture, you need a picture in your head to copy down.
Yeah.
In fact, calligraphy is where you make the picture very precise, and you visualize it on the paper, and you trace it. If you don't do that, you cannot calligraphize.
Mm-hmm.
And teaching people what thinking produces a good result, because the people who are successful architects, you know, don't just visualize the building, they put it in the skyline. And they also go inside the building and find out how long it takes to take the elevator to the top and how the rooms will be. I've been in hotels that I know the architects couldn't visualize at all. To me, the difference between high-quality performance and low-quality performance has to do with how you think things through.
Okay, all right.
To think is what NLP is all about.
What was the most ludicrous process that you saw? And you're like, really? This is how architects think? I mean, what was the one process that you mapped out and you're like, wow, this is bizarre?
You mean of a successful architect or one that wasn't doing so well?
No, I'm just saying any. Like, you've mapped out all these different professions, all these different people. I know that interior designers are schizophrenic or similar, but which one that you did you map out and think, wow, that's...
Well, to me, I know more about the field of psychology because I kept looking for answers there and I kept finding silly things. And, you know, there were things that struck me as crazy. For example, Gestalt therapy, talking to empty furniture to get saner. I mean, I'm sorry, but I don't think you're talking and hallucinating dead relatives and getting mad at them is really going to help you to become a sane person. There is a lot of stuff like that. There's stuff that therapists do that makes schizophrenics look like they're really rational people. I've had psychiatrists look at me with a straight face and describe what they do, and I'm sitting there with my jaw hanging on the ground. I remember once going to a mental hospital, and it was like out of a horror film. It was so horrible. It was an old mental hospital. And having the director of training take me outside for a break, and casually, while I was sitting on a bench looking at the sun, he goes over to his car, pops the trunk open, pulls out a huge pillow and a baseball bat, and begins raging about his mother and whacking the pillow for exactly 3.5 minutes. And then he stopped and switched to his father for another 3.5 minutes, and looks at his watch, and then went on about some other relative, some Uncle Claude. And after a complete session of 12 minutes, he put his pillow back in the car, closed the thing, and when he looked at my face, he realized that I was in a state of shock. And he said, oh, he goes, I could fart for 12 minutes every day at 11:45. And I went, really? I said, does that have something to do with astrology? And he goes, and he looks at me and he goes, oh, astrology is a bunch of bunk. And I thought, boy, there's, a guy throwing a big brick through a glass house. A lot of the ideas of therapy had good intentions, but they didn't notice when they didn't work.
Yeah, see,
as a scientist, if the toaster doesn't make the toast hot, it's not a toaster.
I mean,
to me, in physics, there are a lot of people that talk about physics, but they can't do anything with it. Their theories are elaborate, but yet they can't actually do something. To me, a real scientist produces results. And the measure of success isn't the theory, it's what happens in the world. And somehow or other in the field of psychology, they got way off track. It wasn't the client getting better or getting happier or having good relationships with their own family. They started to believe the relationship with the therapist was more important than what happened outside of the office.
Mm. I love it. All right, so we have Richard Bandler. Thank you. I haven't laughed this hard during an interview in a really long time. You are so much fun.
That's sad, because I'm not trying to be funny.
I know. There must be something wrong with my mind.
The world sometimes it just seems a little nuts.
You're absolutely right. Thank you so much for being here. I absolutely loved it. Hopefully you can come back again. This is fantastic. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, it was a pleasure. Thank you for putting up with me.
All right. Big hug to you. Thank you so much. Okay, bye-bye. Have a great weekend, everybody.